engagement can be directly applicable to another, even if the causes for the war or the goals for the battle are entirely different. The CDF has no such advantage. For example, take a recent battle with the EFG. Oglethorpe tapped on one of the displays to reveal a whale-like creature with massive side tentacles that branched into rudimentary hands. These guys are up to 40 meters long and have a technology that allows them to polymerize water. We'd lose water ships when the water around them turned into a quicksand-like sludge that pulled them down, taking their crews with them. How does the experience of fighting one of these guys translate into experience that can be applied to, say, the Finway? The other screen flipped on, revealing a reptilian charmer, who are small desert dwellers who prefer long-distance biological attacks. The answer is that it really can't. And yet CDF soldiers go from one sort of battle to the other all the time. This is one reason why the mortality rate in the CDF is so high. Every battle is new, and every combat situation, in the experience of the individual soldier at least, is unique. If there's one thing you bring out of these little chats of ours, it's this. Any ideas you have about how war is waged had better be thrown out the window. Your training here will open your eyes to some of what you'll encounter out there, but remember that as infantry, you'll often be the first point of contact with new hostile races whose methods and motives are unknown and sometimes unknowable. You have to think fast and not assume what's worked before will work now. That's a quick way to be dead. One time a recruit asked Oglethorpe why CDF soldiers should even care about the colonists or the colonies.
"We're having it drilled into our heads that we're not even really human anymore," she said. "And if that's the case, why should we feel any attachment to the colonists? They're only human, after all. Why not breed CDF soldiers as the next step in human evolution and give ourselves a leg up?"
"Don't think you're the first one to ask that question," Oglethorpe said, and this got a general chuckle. "The short answer is that we can't. All the genetic and mechanical fiddling that gets done to CDF soldiers renders them genetically sterile. Because of common genetic material used in the template of each of you, there are far too many lethal recessives to allow any fertilization process to get very far. And there's too much non-human material to allow successful crossbreeding with normal humans. CDF soldiers are an amazing bit of engineering, but as an evolutionary path, they're a dead end. This is one reason why none of you should be too smug. You can run a mile in 3 minutes, but you can't make a baby. In a larger sense, however, there's no need. The next step of evolution is already happening. Just like the Earth, most of the colonies are isolated from each other. Nearly all people born on a colony stay there their entire lives. Humans also adapt to their new homes. It's already beginning culturally. Some of the oldest of the colony planets are beginning to show linguistic and cultural drift from their cultures and languages back on Earth. In 10,000 years, there will be genetic drift as well. Given enough time, there will be as many different human species as there are colony planets. Diversity is the key to survival. Metaphysically, maybe you should feel attached to the colonies because, having been changed yourself, you appreciate the human potential to become something that will survive in the universe. More directly, you should care because the colonies represent the future of the human race, and changed or not, you're still far closer to human than any other intelligent species out there. But ultimately, you should care because you're old enough to know that you should. That's one of the reasons the CDF selects old people to become soldiers, you know. It's not just because you're all retired and a drag on the economy. It's also because you've lived long enough to know that there's more to life than your own life. Most of you have raised families and have children and grandchildren and understand the value of doing something beyond your own selfish goals. Even if you never become colonists yourselves, you still recognize that human colonies are good for the human race and worth fighting for. It's hard to drill that concept into the brain of a 19-year-old, but you know from experience. In this universe, experience counts.
We drilled,
We shot. We learned. We kept going. We didn't sleep much. In week 6, I replaced Sarah O'Connell as squad leader. E-Squad consistently fell behind in team exercises, and that was costing the 63rd Platoon in intra-platoon competitions. Every time a trophy went to another platoon, Ruiz would grind his teeth and take it out on me. Sarah accepted it with good grace.
"It's not exactly like hurting kindergartners, unfortunately,"
is what she had to say. Alan took her place and whipped the squad into shape. Week 7 found the 63rd shooting a trophy right out from under the 58th. Ironically, it was Sarah, who turned out to be a hell of a shot, who took us over the top. In week 8, I stopped talking to my brain pal. Asshole had studied me long enough to understand my brain patterns and began seemingly anticipating my needs. I first noticed it during a simulated live-fire exercise, when my MP-35 switched from rifle rounds to guided missile rounds, tracked, fired, and hit 2 long-range targets, and then switched again to a flamethrower just in time to fry a nasty 6-foot bug that popped out of some nearby rocks. When I realized I hadn't vocalized any of the commands, I felt a creepy vibe wash over me. After another few days, I noticed I became annoyed whenever I would actually have to ask Asshole for something. How quickly the creepy becomes commonplace. In week 9, I, Alan, and Martin Garabedian had to provide a little administrative discipline to one of Martin's recruits, who had decided that he wanted Martin's squad leader job and was not above attempting a little sabotage to get it. The recruit had been a moderately famous pop star in his past life and was used to getting his way through whatever means necessary. He was crafty enough to enlist some squad mates into the conspiracy, but unfortunately for him, was not smart enough to realize that as his squad leader, Martin had access to the notes he was passing. Martin came to me. I suggested that there was no reason to involve Ruiz or the other instructors in what could easily be resolved by ourselves. If anyone noticed a base hovercraft briefly going AWOL later that night, they didn't say anything. Likewise, if anyone saw a recruit dangling from it upside down as it passed dangerously close to some trees, the recruit held to the hovercraft only by a pair of hands on each ankle. Certainly no one claimed to hear either the recruit's desperate screaming or Martin's critical and none-too-favorable examination of the former pop star's most famous album. Master Sergeant Ruiz did note to me at breakfast the next morning that I was looking a little windblown. I replied that it may have been the brisk 30-mile jog he had us run prior to the meal. In week 11, the 63rd and several other platoons dropped into the mountains north of the base. The objective was simple. Find and wipe out every other platoon, and then have the survivors make it back to base all within 4 days. To make things interesting, each recruit was fitted with a device that registered shots taken at them. If one connected, the recruit would feel paralyzing pain and then collapse, and then be retrieved eventually by drill instructors watching nearby. I knew this because I'd been the test case back on base when Ruiz wanted to show an example. I stressed to my platoon that they did not want to feel what I felt. The first attack came almost as soon as we hit the ground. 4 of my recruits went down before I spotted the shooters and called them to the attention of the platoon. We got 2. 2 got away. Sporadic attacks over the next few hours made it clear that most of the other platoons had broken into squads of 3 or 4 and were hunting for other squads. I had another idea. Our brain pals made it possible for us to maintain constant silent contact with each other regardless of whether we were standing close to one another or not. Other platoons seemed to be missing the implications of this fact, but that was too bad for them. I had every member of the platoon open a secure BrainPal communication line with every other member, and then I had each platoon member head off individually, charting terrain and noting the location of enemy squads they spotted. This way, we would all have an ever-widening map of the ground and the positions of the enemy. Even if one of our recruits got picked off, the information they provided would help another platoon member avenge his or her death, or at least keep from getting killed right away. One soldier could move quickly and silently and harass the other platoon squads and still work in tandem with other soldiers when the opportunity arose. It worked. Our recruits took shots when they could, laid low and passed on information when they couldn't, and worked together when opportunities presented themselves. On the second day, I and a recruit named Riley picked off two squads from opposing platoons. They were so busy shooting at each other that they didn't notice Riley and me sniping them from a distance. He got two, I got three, and the other three apparently got each other. It was pretty sweet. After we were done, we didn't say anything to each other, just faded back into the forest and kept tracking and sharing terrain information. Eventually, the other platoons figured out what we were doing and tried to do the same, but by that time there were too many of the 63rd and not enough of them. We mopped them up, getting the last of them by noon, and then started our jog into base some 80 clicks away. The last of us made it in by 1800. In the end, we lost 19 members of the platoon, including the four at the beginning, but we were responsible for just over half of the total kills across seven other platoons, while losing less than a third of our own people. Even Master Sergeant Ruiz couldn't complain about that. When the base commander awarded him the War Games trophy, he even cracked a smile. I can't even imagine how much it hurt him to do that.
Our luck will never cease, the newly minted Private Alan Rosenthal said as he came up to me at the shuttle boarding area. You and I got assigned to the same ship.
Indeed we had. A quick jaunt back to Phoenix on the troop ship Francis Drake, and then leave until the CDFS Modesto came to call. Then we'd hook up with the 2nd Platoon Company D of the 233rd CDF Infantry Battalion. One battalion per ship, roughly 1,000 soldiers. Easy to get lost. I'd be glad to have Alan with me once again. I glanced over to Alan and admired his clean, new colonial blue dress uniform, in no small part because I was wearing one just like it.
Damn, Alan, I said. We sure look good.
I've always loved a man in uniform, Alan said to me. And now that I'm the man in the uniform, I love him even more.
Uh-oh, I said. Here comes Master Sergeant Ruiz.
Ruiz had spotted me waiting to board my shuttle. As he approached, I put down the duffel bag that contained my everyday uniform and few remaining personal belongings, and presented him with a smart salute.
At ease, Private,
Ruiz said, returning the salute.
Where are you headed?
The Modesto, Master Sergeant, I said. Private Rosenthal and I both.
You're shitting me,
Ruiz declared.
The 233rd? Which company?
D, Master Sergeant, 2nd Platoon.
Out fucking standing, Private,
Ruiz said.
You will have the pleasure in serving the platoon of Lieutenant Arthur Keyes if that dumb son of a bitch hasn't managed to have his ass chewed on by now by some alien or another. When you see him, extend to him my compliments if you would. You may additionally tell him that Master Sergeant Antonio Ruiz has declared that you are not nearly the dipshit that most of your fellow recruits have turned out to be. Thank you, Master Sergeant.
Don't let it go to your head, Private. You are still a dipshit, just not a very big one.
Of course, Master Sergeant.
Good. And now, if you will excuse me, sometimes you just gotta hit the road.
Master Sergeant Ruiz saluted. Alan and I saluted back. Ruiz glanced at us both, offered a tight, tight smile, and then walked away without looking back.
That man scares the shit out of me, Alan said.
I don't know. I kind of like him.
Of course you do. He thinks you're almost not a dipshit. That's a compliment in his world.
I don't think I don't know it, I said.
Now all I have to do is live up to it.
You'll manage, Alan said. After all, you do still get to be a dipshit.
That's comforting, I said.
At least I'll have company.
Alan grinned. The shuttle doors opened. We grabbed our stuff and went inside. Chapter 9.
I can take a shot, Watson said, sighting over his boulder. Let me drill one of those things.
No, said Viveros, our corporal. Their shield is still up. You'd just be wasting ammo.
Oh, this is bullshit, Watson said. We've been here for hours. We're sitting here, they're sitting there. When their shield goes down, we're supposed to what? Walk over and start blasting at them? This isn't the fucking 14th century. We shouldn't make an appointment to start killing the other guy.
Viveros looked irritated. Watson, you're not paid to think, so shut the fuck up and get ready. It's not going to be long now, anyway. There's only one thing left in their ritual before we get at it.
Yeah, what's that? Watson said.
They're going to sing, Vivero said. Watson smirked.
What are they going to sing? Show tunes?
No, Vivero said. They're going to sing our deaths.
As if on cue, the massive hemispherical shield enclosing the Khonsu encampment shimmered at the base. I adjusted my eyesight and focused down the several hundred meters across the field as a single Khonsu stepped through, the shield lightly sticking to its massive carapace until it moved far enough away for the electrostatic filaments to collapse back into the shield. He was the third and final Khonsu that would emerge out of the shield before the battle. The first had appeared nearly 12 hours ago, a low-ranking grunt whose bellowing challenge served to formally signal the Khonsu's intent to battle. The low rank of the messenger was meant to convey the minimal regard in which our troops were held by the Khonsu, the idea being that if we had been really important, they would have sent a higher up. None of our troops took offense. The messenger was always of low rank, regardless of opponent, and anyway, unless you are extraordinarily sensitive to Khonsu pheromones, they pretty much all look alike. The second Khonsu emerged from behind the shield several hours later, bellowed like a herd of cows caught in a thresher, and then promptly exploded. Pinkish blood and bits of his organs and carapace momentarily splashing against the Khonsu's shield, and sizzling lightly as they drizzled down to the ground. Apparently the Khonsu believed that if a single soldier was ritually prepared beforehand, its soul can be persuaded to reconnoiter the enemy for a set amount of time before moving on to wherever it is Khonsu souls go, or something along that line. This is a signal honor, not lightly given. This seemed to me to be a fine way to lose your best soldiers in a hurry, but given that I was one of the enemy, it was hard to see the downside for us in the practice. This third Khonsu was a member of the highest caste, and his role was simply to tell us the reasons for our death and manner by which we would all die, after which point we would actually get to the killing and dying. Any attempt to hasten things along by preemptively taking a shot at the shield would be useless. Short of dropping it into a stellar core, there was very little that could ding a Khonsu shield. Killing a messenger would accomplish nothing other than causing the opening rituals to be restarted, delaying the fighting and killing even more. Besides, the Khonsu weren't hiding behind the shield. They just had a lot of pre-battle rituals to take care of, and they preferred that they were not interrupted by the inconvenient appearance of bullets, particle beams, or explosives. Truth was, there was nothing the Khonsu liked better than a good fight. They thought nothing of the idea of tromping off to some planet, setting themselves down, and daring the natives to pry them off in battle. Which was the case here. The Khonsu were entirely disinterested in colonizing this planet. They had merely blasted a human colony here into bits as a way of letting the CDF know they were in the neighborhood and looking for some action. Ignoring the Khonsu wasn't a possibility, as they'd simply keep killing off colonists until someone came to fight them on a formal basis. You never knew what they'd consider enough for a formal challenge, either. You just kept adding troops until a Khonsu messenger came out and announced the battle.
Aside from their impressive, impenetrable shields, the Khonsu's battle technology was of a similar level as the CDF's. This was not as encouraging as you might think, as what reports filtered back from Khonsu battles with other species indicated that the Khonsu's weaponry and technology was always more or less matched with that of their opponent. This added to the idea that what the Khonsu were engaging in was not war, but sports. Not unlike a football game, except with slaughtered colonists in the place of proper spectators. Striking first against Khonsu was not an option. Their entire inner home system was shielded. The energy to generate the shield came from the white dwarf companion of the Khonsu sun. It had been completely encased with some sort of harvesting mechanism so that all the energy coming off it would fuel the shield. Realistically speaking, you just don't fuck with people who can do that. But the Khonsu had a weird honor system. Clean them off a planet in battle, and they didn't come back. It was like the battle was the vaccination and we were the antiviral. All of this information was provided by our mission database, which our commanding officer, Lieutenant Keyes, had directed us to access and read before the battle. The fact that Watson didn't seem to know any of this meant he hadn't accessed the report. This was not entirely surprising, since from the first moment I met Watson, it was clear that he was the sort of cocky, willfully ignorant son of a bitch who would get himself or his squadmates killed. My problem was, I was his squadmate. The Khonsu unfolded its slashing arms. Specialized at some point in their evolution to deal with some unimaginably horrifying creature on their home world, most likely, and underneath its more recognizably arm-like forelimbs raised to the sky. "It's starting," Vivero said.
"I could pop him so easy," Watson said.
"Do it and I'll shoot you myself," Vivero said. The sky cracked with a sound like God's own rifle shot, followed by what sounded like a chainsaw ripping through a tin roof. The Khonsu was singing. I accessed Asshole and had it translate from the beginning.
"Behold, honored adversaries," it began. "We are the instruments of your joyful death. In our ways we have blessed you. The spirit of the best among us has sanctified our battle. We will praise you as we move among you and sing your souls saved to their rewards. It is not your fortune to have been born among the people, so we set you upon the path that leads to redemption. Be brave and fight with fierceness, that you may come into our fold at your rebirth. This blessed battle hallows the ground, and all who die and are born here, henceforth, are delivered."
"Damn, that's loud," Watson said, sticking a finger in his left ear and twisting.
I doubted he had bothered to get a translation.
"This isn't a war or a football game, for Christ's sake," I said to Viveros. "This is a baptism."
Viveros shrugged. "CDF doesn't think so. This is how they start every battle. They think it's their equivalent of the national anthem. It's just ritual. Look, the shield's coming down."
She motioned towards the shield, which was now flickering and failing across its entire length.
"About fucking time," Watson said. "I was about to take a nap."
"Listen to me, both of you," Vivero said. "Stay calm, stay focused, and keep your ass down. We've got a good position here, and the lieutenant wants us to snipe these bastards as they come down. Nothing flashy, just shoot them in the thorax. That's where their brains are. Everyone we get means one less for the rest of them to worry about. Rifle shots only, anything else is just going to give us away faster. Cut the chatter. Brain pals only from here on out. You get me?"
"We get you," I said.
"Fucking A," Watson said.
"Excellent," Vivero said.
The shield finally failed, and the field separating human and Khonsu was instantly streaked with the trails of rockets which had been sighted and readied for hours. The concussive burps of their explosions were immediately followed by human screams and the metallic chirps of Khonsu. For a few seconds there was nothing but smoke and silence. Then a long, serrated cry as the Khonsu surged forward to engage the humans, who in turn kept their positions and tried to cut down as many Khonsu as they could before their two fronts collided. "Let's get to it," Vivero said. And with that she raised her MP, sighted it on some far distant Khonsu, and began to fire. We quickly followed. How to prepare for battle. First, systems check your MP-35 infantry rifle. This is the easy part. MP-35s are self-monitoring and self-repairing and can, in a pinch, use material from an ammunition block as raw material to fix a malfunction. Just about the only way you can permanently ruin an MP is to place it in the path of a firing maneuvering thruster. Inasmuch as you're likely to be attached to your weapon at the time, if this is the case, you have other problems to worry about. Second, put on your war suit. This is the standard self-sealing body-length unitard that covers everything but the face. The unitard is designed to let you forget about your body for the length of the battle. The fabric of organized nanobots lets in light for photosynthesis and regulates heat. Stand on an Arctic floe or a Saharan sand dune, and the only difference your body notes is the visual change in scenery. If you somehow managed to sweat, your unitard wicks it away, filters it, and stores the water until you can transfer it to a canteen. You can deal with urine this way, too. Defecating in your unitard is generally not recommended. Get a bullet in your gut, or anywhere else, and the unitard stiffens at the point of impact and transfers the energy across the surface of the suit, rather than allowing the bullet to burrow through. This is massively painful, but better than letting a bullet ricochet merrily through your intestines. This only works up to a point, alas, so avoiding enemy fire is still the order of the day. Add your belt, which includes your combat knife, your multi-purpose tool, which is what a Swiss Army knife wants to be when it grows up, an impressively collapsible personal shelter, your canteen, a week's worth of energy wafers, and 3 slots for ammo blocks. Smear your face with a nanobot-laden cream that interfaces with your unitard to share environmental information. Switch on your camouflage. Try to find yourself in the mirror. Third, open a brain pal channel to the rest of your squad and leave it open until you return to the ship or you die. I thought I was pretty smart to think of this in boot camp, but it turns out to be one of the holiest of unofficial rules during the heat of battle. Brain pal communication means no unclear commands or signals, and no speaking to give away your position. If you hear a CDF soldier during the heat of battle, it's because he is either stupid or screaming because he's been shot. The only drawback to brain pal communication is that your brain pal can also send emotional information if you're not paying attention. This can be distracting if you suddenly feel like you're going to piss yourself in fright, only to realize it's not you who's about to cut loose on the bladder, but your squad mate. It's also something none of your squad mates will ever let you live down. Link only to your squad mates. Try to keep a channel open to your entire platoon and suddenly 60 people are cursing, fighting, and dying inside your head. You do not need this. Finally, forget everything except to follow orders. Kill anything that's not human and stay alive. The CDF makes it simple to do this. For the first 2 years of service, every soldier is infantry. No matter if you were a janitor or surgeon, senator or street bum in your previous life. If you make it through the first 2 years, then you get the chance to specialize, to earn a permanent colonial billet instead of wandering from battle to battle, and to fill in the niche and support roles every military body has. But for 2 years, all you have to do is go where they tell you, stay behind your rifle, and kill and not be killed. It's simple. But simple isn't the same as easy. It took 2 shots to bring down a Khonsu soldier. This was new. None of the intelligence on them mentioned personal shielding, but something was allowing them to take the first hit. It sprawled them on whatever you might consider to be their asses, but they were up again in a matter of seconds. So two shots, one to take them down, and one to keep them down. Two shots in sequence on the same moving target is not easily accomplished when you're firing across a few hundred meters of very busy battleground. After figuring this one out, I had Asshole create a specialized firing routine that shot two bullets on one trigger pull, the first a hollow tip, and the second with an explosive charge. The specification was relayed to my MP between shots. 1 second I was squeezing off single standard issue rifle ammo, the next I was shooting my Kansu Killer Special. I loved my rifle. I forwarded the firing specification to Watson and Viveros. Viveros forwarded it up the chain of command. Within about a minute, the battlefield was peppered with the sound of rapid double shots, followed by dozens of Kansu puffing out as the explosive charges strained their internal organs against the insides of their carapaces. It sounded like popcorn popping. I glanced over at Viveros. She was emotionlessly sighting and shooting. Watson was firing and grinning like a boy who just won a stuffed animal at the State Farm BB shoot. "Uh-oh," sent Viveros. "We're spotted. Get down."
"What?"
Watson said, and poked his head up. I grabbed him and pulled down as the rockets slammed into the boulders we'd been using for cover. We were pelted with newly formed gravel. I looked up just in time to see a chunk of boulder the size of a bowling ball twirling madly down towards my skull. I swatted at it without thinking. The suit went hard down the length of my arm, and the chunk flew off like a lazy softball. My arm ached. In my other life, I'd be the proud owner of 3 new, short, likely terribly misaligned arm bones. I wouldn't be doing that again.
"Holy shit, that was close," said Watson.
"Shut up,"
I said, and sent to Viveros.
"What now?"
"Hold tight,"
she sent, and took her multi-purpose tool of her belt. She ordered it into a mirror, then used it to peek over the edge of her boulder.
6, no, 7, on their way up."
There was a sudden crump close by.
"Make that 5.
She corrected, and closed up her tool. "Set for grenades, then follow up, then we move." I nodded. Watson grinned, and when Viveros sent go, we all pumped grenades over the boulders. I counted 3 each. After 9 explosions, I exhaled, prayed, popped up and saw the remains of 1 Kansu, another dragging itself dazedly away from our position, and 2 scrambling for cover. Viveros got the wounded one. Watson and I each plugged 1 of the other 2.
"Welcome to the party, you shitheads!"
Watson whooped, and then bobbled up exultantly over his boulder just in time to get it in the face from the 5th Kansu, who had gotten ahead of the grenades and had stayed low while we mopped up its friends. The Kansu leveled a barrel at Watson's nose and fired. Watson's face cratered inward, and then outward as a geyser of smart blood and tissue that used to be Watson's head sprayed over the Kansu. Watson's unitard, designed to stiffen when hit by projectiles, did just that when the shot hit the back of his hood, pressuring the shot, the smart blood, and bits of skull, brain, and brain pal back out the only readily available opening. Watson didn't know what hit him. The last thing he sent through his brain pal channel was a wash of emotion that could best be described as disoriented puzzlement, the mild surprise of someone who knows he's seeing something he wasn't expecting but hasn't figured out what it is. Then his connection was cut off, like a data feed suddenly, unexpectedly shut down. The Kansu who shot Watson sang as it blew his face apart. I had left my translation circuit on, and so I saw Watson's death subtitled, the word redeemed repeated over and over while bits of his head formed weeping droplets on the Kansu's thorax. I screamed and fired. The Kansu slammed backwards, and then its body exploded as bullet after bullet dug under its thoracic plate and detonated. I figured I wasted 30 rounds on an already dead Kansu before I stopped.
"Barry,"
Vivero said, switching back to her voice to snap me out of whatever I was in.
More on the way. Time to move. Let's go.
What about Watson? I asked.
Leave him, Vivero said.
He's dead and you're not, and there's no one to mourn him out here anyway. We'll come for the body later. Let's go. Let's stay alive.
We won. The double bullet rifle technique thinned out the Khonsu herd by a substantial amount before they got wise and moved to switch tactics, falling back to launch rocket attacks rather than to make another frontal assault. After several hours of this, the Khonsu fell back completely and fired up their shield, leaving behind a squad to ritually commit suicide, signaling the Khonsu acceptance of their loss. After they had plunged their ceremonial knives into their brain cavity, all that was left was to collect our dead and what wounded had been left in the field. For the day, 2nd Platoon came through pretty well. 2 dead, including Watson, and 4 wounded, only 1 seriously. She'd be spending the next month growing back her lower intestine, while the other 3 would be up and back on duty in a matter of days. All things considered, things could have been worse. A Khonsu-armored hovercraft had rammed its way toward 4th Platoon Company C's position and detonated, taking 16 of them with it, including the platoon commander and 2 squad leaders, and wounding much of the rest of the platoon. If 4th Platoon's lieutenant weren't already dead, I'd suspect he'd be wishing he were after a clusterfuck like that. After we received an all-clear from Lieutenant Keyes, I went back to get Watson. A group of 8-legged scavengers were already at him. I shot one, and that encouraged the rest to disperse. They had made impressive progress on him in a short amount of time. I was sort of darkly surprised at how much less someone weighed after you subtracted his head and much of his soft tissues. I put what was left of him in a fireman's carry and started on the couple of clicks to the temporary morgue. I had to stop and vomit only once. Alan spied me on the way in.
"Need any help?"
he said, coming up alongside me.
"I'm fine," I said. "He's not heavy anymore."
"Who is it?"
Alan said.
"Watson,"
I said.
"Oh, him,"
Alan said and grimaced.
"Well, I'm sure someone somewhere will miss him."
"Try not to get all weepy on me," I said. "How did you do today?"
"Not bad,"
Alan said.
"I kept my head down most of the time, poked my rifle up every now and then, and shot a few rounds in the general direction of the enemy. I may have hit something. I don't know."
"Did you listen to the death chant before the battle?"
"Of course I did," Alan said. "It sounded like 2 freight trains mating. It's not something you can choose not to hear."
"No," I said. "I mean, did you get a translation? Did you listen to what it was saying?"
"Yeah," Alan said. "I'm not sure I like their plan for converting us to their religion, seeing as it involves dying and all."
"Yeah, the CDF seems to think it's just ritual, like it's a prayer they recite because it's something they've always done," I said.
"What do you think?"
Alan asked. I jerked my head back to indicate Watson.
"The Khonsu that killed him was screaming, 'Redeemed, redeemed,' as loud as he could, and I'm sure he'd have done the same thing while he was gutting me. I'm thinking the CDF is underestimating what's going on here. I think the reason the Khonsu don't come back after one of these battles isn't because they think they've lost. I don't think this battle is really about winning or losing. By their lights, this planet is now consecrated by blood. I think they own it now."
"Then why don't they occupy it?"
"Maybe it's not time," I said. "Maybe they have to wait until some sort of Armageddon. But my point is, I don't think the CDF knows whether the Khonsu consider this their property now or not. I think somewhere down the line they're going to be mightily surprised."
"Okay, I'll buy that," Alan said. "Every military I've ever heard of has a history of smugness, but what do you propose to do about it?"
"Shit, Alan, I haven't the slightest idea," I said, "other than to try to be long dead when it happens."
"On an entirely different, less depressing subject,"
Alan said,
Good job thinking up the firing solution for the battle. Some of us were really getting pissed off that we'd shoot those bastards and they'd just get up and keep coming. You're going to get your drinks bought for you for the next couple of weeks.
We don't pay for drinks, I said. This is an all-expense tour of hell, if you'll recall.
Well, if we did, you would, Alan said.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not that big of a deal,
I said, and then noticed that Alan had stopped and was standing at attention. I looked up and saw Viveros, Lieutenant Keyes, and some officer I didn't recognize striding towards me. I stopped and waited for them to reach me.
Perry,
Lieutenant Keyes said.
Lieutenant, I said. Please forgive the lack of salute, sir. I'm carrying a dead body to the morgue.
That's where they go,
Keyes said, and motioned at the corpse.
Who is that?
Watson, sir.
Oh, him,
Keyes said.
Well, that didn't take very long, did it?
He was excitable, sir, I said.
Yeah, I suppose he was, Keyes said.
Well, anyway, Perry, this is Lieutenant Colonel Rybicki, the 233rd's commander.
Sir, I said.
Sorry about not saluting.
Yes, dead body, I know, said Rybicki. Son, I just wanted to congratulate you on your firing solution today. You saved a lot of time and lives. Those Khonsu bastards keep switching things up on us. Those personal shields were a new touch, and they were giving us a hell of a lot of trouble there. I'm putting you in for a commendation, Private. What do you think about that?
Thank you, sir, I said. But I'm sure someone else would have figured it out eventually.
Probably, but you figured it out first, and that counts for something.
Yes, sir.
When we get back to the Modesto, I hope you'll let an old infantry man buy you a drink, son.
I'd like that, sir, I said.
I saw Alan smirk in the background.
Well, then, congratulations again.
Rybicki motioned at Watson.
And, sorry about your friend.
Thank you, sir.
Alan saluted for the both of us. Rybicki saluted back and wheeled off, followed by Keyes. Viveros turned back to me and Alan.
You seem amused, Viveros said to me.
I was just thinking that it's been about 50 years since anyone called me son, I said.
Viveros smiled and indicated Watson.
You know where you're taking him? She asked.
Yeah, morgue's just over that ridge, I said. I'm going to drop off Watson, and then I'd like to catch the first transport back to the Modesto, if that's okay.
Shit, Perry, Viveros said. You're the hero of the day. You can do anything you want.
She turned to go.
Hey, Viveros, I said. Is it always like this?
She turned back.
Is what always like this?
Well, this, I said. War, battles, fighting.
What?
Viveros said, and then snorted.
Hell no, Perry. Today was a cakewalk. This is as easy as it gets.
And then she trotted off, highly amused. That was how my first battle went. My era of war had begun. Chapter 10 Maggie was the first of the old farts to die. She died in the upper atmosphere of a colony named Temperance, an irony because, like most colonies with a heavy mining industry, it was sprinkled liberally with bars and brothels. Temperance's metal-laden crust had made it a hard colony to get, and a difficult one for humans to keep. The permanent CDF presence there was 3 times the usual colonial complement, and they were always sending additional troops to back them up. Maggie's ship, the Dayton, caught one of these assignments when Ohu forces dropped into Temperance space and salted an army's worth of drone warriors onto the surface of the planet. Maggie's platoon was supposed to be part of the effort to take back an aluminum mine 100 clicks out of Murphy, Temperance's main port. They never made it to the ground. On the way down, her troop transport hull was struck by an Ohu missile. It tore open the hull and sucked several soldiers into space, including Maggie. Most of these soldiers died instantly from the force of the impact or by chunks of the hull tearing into their bodies. Maggie wasn't one of them.
She was sucked out into the space above Temperance, fully conscious, her combat unitard automatically closing around her face to keep the air from vomiting out of her lungs. Maggie immediately messaged to her squad and platoon leader. What was left of her squad leader was flopping about in his descent harness. Her platoon leader wasn't much more help, but he wasn't to blame. The troop ship was not equipped for space rescue and was in any event gravely damaged and limping under fire towards the closest CDF ship to discharge its surviving passengers. A message to the Dayton itself was likewise fruitless. The Dayton was exchanging fire with several Ohu ships and could not dispatch rescue, nor could any other ship. In non-battle situations, she was already too small a target, too far down Temperance's gravity well and too close to Temperance's atmosphere for anything but the most heroic retrieval attempts. In a pitched battle situation, she was already dead. And so, Maggie, whose smart blood was by now reaching its oxygen-carrying limit, and whose body was undoubtedly beginning to scream for oxygen, took her MP, aimed it at the nearest Ohu ship, computed a trajectory, and unloaded rocket after rocket. Each rocket burst provided an equal and opposite burst of thrust to Maggie, speeding her towards Temperance's darkened nighttime sky. Battle data would later show that her rockets, propellant long spent, did indeed impact against the Ohu ship, dealing some minor damage. Then Maggie turned, faced the planet that would kill her, and like a good professor of Eastern religions that she used to be, she composed Jitsei, the death poem, in the haiku form. Do not mourn me, friends. I fall as a shooting star into the next life. She sent it and the last moments of her life to the rest of us, and then she died, hurtling brightly across the Temperance night sky. She was my friend. Briefly, she was my lover. She was braver than I ever would have been in the moment of death. And I bet she was a hell of a shooting star. The problem with the Colonial Defense Force is not that it isn't an excellent fighting force, it's that it's far too easy to use. Thus spoke Thaddeus Bender, two-time Democratic senator from Massachusetts, former ambassador at various times to France, Japan, and the United Nations, Secretary of State in the otherwise disastrous Crow administration, author, lecturer, and, finally, the latest addition to Platoon D. Since the latest of these had the most relevance to the rest of us, we had all decided that Private Senator Ambassador Secretary Bender was well and truly full of crap. It's amazing how quickly one goes from being fresh meat to being an old hand. On our arrival to the Modesto, Alan and I received our billets, were greeted cordially, if perfunctorily, by Lieutenant Keyes, who raised an eyebrow when we passed along Sergeant Ruiz's compliments, and were treated with benign neglect by the rest of the platoon. Our squad leaders addressed us when we needed to be addressed, and our squad mates passed on information we needed to know. Otherwise, we were out of the loop. It wasn't personal. The three other new guys, Watson, Gaiman, and McKean, all got the same treatment, which centered on two facts. The first was that when new guys come in, it was because some old guy has gone. And typically, gone meant dead. Institutionally, soldiers can be replaced like cogs. On the platoon and squad level, however, you're replacing a friend, a squad mate, someone who had fought and won and died. The idea that you, whoever you are, could be a replacement or a substitute for that dead friend and teammate is mildly offensive to those who knew him or her. Secondly, of course, you simply haven't fought yet, and until you do, you're not one of them. You can't be. It's not your fault, and in any event, it will be quickly corrected. But until you're in the field, you're just some guy taking up space where a better man or woman used to be. I noticed the difference immediately after our battle with the Khonsu. I was greeted by name, invited to share mess hall tables, asked to play pool, or dragged into conversations. Viveros, my squad leader, started asking my opinion about things instead of telling me how things would be. Lieutenant Keyes told me a story about Sergeant Ruiz involving a hovercraft and a colonial's daughter that I simply did not believe. In short, I'd become one of them, one of us. The Khonsu firing solution and the subsequent commendation helped, but Allen, Gaiman, and McKean were also welcomed into the fold, and they didn't do anything but fight and not get killed. It's enough. Now, 3 months in, we'd had a few more rounds of fresh meat come through the platoon and seen them replace people we had befriended. We knew how the platoon felt when we came to take someone else's place. We had the same reaction. Until you fight, you're just taking up space. Most fresh meat clued in, understood, and toughed out the first few days until we saw some action. Private Senator Ambassador Secretary Bender, however, was having none of this. From the moment he showed up, he had been ingratiating himself to the platoon, visiting each member personally and attempting to establish a deep personal relationship. It was annoying. "It's like he's campaigning for something," Allen complained, and this was not far off. A lifetime of running for office will do that to you. You just don't know when to shut it off. Private Senator Ambassador Secretary Bender also had a lifetime of assuming people were passionately interested in what it was he had to say, which is why he wouldn't ever shut up, even when no one appeared to be listening. So when he was opining wildly on the CDF's problems in mess hall, he was essentially talking to himself. Be that as it may, his statement was provocative enough to get a rise out of Viveros, with whom I was lunching.
"Excuse me," she said. "Would you mind repeating that last bit?"
I said, "I think the problem with the CDF is not that it's not a good fighting force, but that it's too easy to use," Bender repeated.
"Really?"
Viveros said.
"This I have to hear."
"Well, it's simple, really,"
Bender said,
and shifted into a position that I immediately recognized from pictures of him back on Earth, hands out and slightly curved inward, as if to grasp the concept he was illuminating in order to give it to others. Now that I was on the receiving end of the movement, I realized how condescending it was. There's no doubt the Colonial Defense Force is an extremely capable fighting force, but in a very real sense, that's not the issue. The issue is, what are we doing to avoid its use? Are there times when the CDF has been deployed where intensive diplomatic efforts might not have yielded better results?"
"You must have missed the speech I got," I said. "You know, the one about it not being a perfect universe and competition for real estate and the universe being fast and furious."
"Oh, I heard it," Bender said. "I just don't know that I believe it. There are how many stars in this galaxy? 100 million or so? Most of which have a system of planets of some sort. The real estate is functionally infinite. No, I think the real issue here may be that the reason we use force when we deal with other intelligent alien species is that force is the easiest thing to use. It's fast, it's straightforward, and compared to the complexities of diplomacy, it's simple. You either hold a piece of land or you don't. As opposed to diplomacy, which is intellectually a much more difficult enterprise."
Viveros glanced over to me and then back to Bender. "You think what we're doing is simple?"
"Oh, no," Bender smiled and held up a hand placatingly. "I said simple relative to diplomacy. If I give you a gun and tell you to take a hill from its inhabitants, the situation is relatively simple. But if I tell you to go to the inhabitants and negotiate a settlement that allows you to acquire that hill, there's a lot going on. What do you do with the current inhabitants? How are they compensated? What rights do they continue to have regarding the hill? And so on."
"Assuming the hill people don't just shoot you as you drop by, diplomatic pouch in hand," I said.
Bender smiled at me and pointed vigorously. "See? That's exactly it. We assume that our opposite numbers have the same warlike perspective as we do. But what if the door were opened to diplomacy, even just a crack? Would not any intelligent, sentient species choose to walk through that door? Well, let's take, for example, the Wa'id people. We're about to war on them, aren't we?
Indeed we were. The Wa'idians and humans had been circling each other for more than a decade, fighting over the Earnhardt system, which featured three planets habitable to both our people. Systems with multiple inhabitable planets were fairly rare. The Wa'idians were tenacious, but also relatively weak. Their network of planets was small, and most of their industry was still concentrated on their home world. Since the Wa'id would not take the hint and stay out of the Earnhardt system, the plan was to skip to Wa'id space, smash their spaceport and major industrial zones, and set their expansionary capabilities back a couple of decades or so. The 233rd would be part of the task force that was set to land in their capital city and tear the place up a bit. We were to avoid killing civilians when we could, but otherwise knock a few holes in their parliament houses and religious gathering centers and so on. There was no industrial advantage to doing this, but it sends the message that we can mess with them any time just because we feel like it. It shakes them up.
What about them? Viveros asked.
Well, I've done a little research into these people, Bender said. They've got a remarkable culture, you know. Their highest art form is a form of mass chant that's like a Gregorian round. They'll get an entire city full of Wa'idians and start chanting. It's said you can hear the chant for dozens of clicks, and the chants can go on for hours.
So,
this is a culture we should be celebrating and exploring, not bottling up on its planet simply because they're in our way. Have the colonials even attempted to reach a peace with these people? I see no record of an attempt. I think we should make an attempt. Maybe an attempt could be made by us.
Viveros snorted. Negotiating a treaty is a little beyond our orders, Bender.
In my first term as senator, I went to Northern Ireland as part of a trade junket and ended up extracting a peace treaty from the Catholics and the Protestants. I didn't have the authority to make an agreement, and it caused a huge controversy back in the States, but when an opportunity for peace arises, we must needs take it, Bender said.
I remember that, I said. That was right before the bloodiest marching season in 2 centuries. Not a very successful peace agreement.
That wasn't the fault of the agreement, Bender said, somewhat defensively. Some drugged-out Catholic kid threw a grenade into an Orange Men's march, and it was all over after that.
Damn, real live people getting in the way of your peaceful ideals, I said.
Look, I already said diplomacy wasn't easy, Bender said. But I think that ultimately we have more to gain by trying to work with these people than we have by trying to wipe them out. It's an option that should at least be on the table.
Thanks for the seminar, Bender, Vivero said. Now, if you'll yield the floor, I have 2 points to make here. The first is that until you fight, what you know or what you think you know out here means shit to me and to everyone else. This isn't Northern Ireland, it's not Washington, D.C., and it's not planet Earth. When you joined up as a soldier, and you better remember that. Second, no matter what you think, private, your responsibility right now isn't to the universe or to humanity at large. It's to me, your squad mates, your platoon, and to the CDF. When you're given an order, you'll follow it. If you go beyond the scope of your orders, you're going to have to answer to me. Do you get me?
Bender regarded Viveros somewhat coolly.
Much evil has been done under the guise of just following orders, he said. I hope we never have to find ourselves using the same excuse.
Viveros narrowed her eyes.
I'm done eating, she said,
and got up, taking her tray with her. Bender arched his eyebrows as she left.
I didn't mean to offend her, he said to me.
I regarded Bender carefully. Do you recognize the name Viveros at all, Bender? I asked. He frowned a bit.
It's not familiar, he said.
Think way back, I said. We would have been about 5 or 6 or so. A light went on in his head. There was a Peruvian president named Viveros. He was assassinated, I think. Pedro Viveros, that's right, I said. And not just him. His wife, his brother's wife, and most of their families were murdered in the military coup. Only one of Pedro's daughters survived. Her nanny stuffed her down a laundry chute while the soldiers went through the presidential palace looking for family members. The nanny was raped before they slit her throat, incidentally. Bender turned a greenish shade of gray.
She can't be the daughter, he said.
She is, I said. And you know what? When the coup was put down and the soldiers who killed her family were put on trial, their excuse was that they were just following orders. So regardless of whether your point there was well made or not, you made it to just about the last person in the universe to whom you ought to lecture on the banality of evil. She knows all about it. It slaughtered her family while she lay in a basement laundry cart, bleeding and trying not to cry.
God, I'm sorry, of course, Bender said. I wouldn't have said anything, but I didn't know.
Of course you didn't, Bender, I said. And that was Viveros's point. Out here you don't know. You don't know anything.
Listen up, Viveros said on the way down to the surface. Our job is strictly to smash and dash. We're landing near the center of their government operations. Blast buildings and structures, but avoid shooting live targets unless CDF forces are targeted first. We've already kicked these people in the balls. Now we're just pissing on them while they're down. Be fast, do damage, and get back. Are we clear? The operation had been a cakewalk up to that point. The Wyidians had been utterly unprepared for the sudden and instantaneous arrival of 2 dozen CDF battleships in their home space. The CDF had opened up a diversionary offensive in the Earnhardt system several days before to lure Wyidian ships there to support the battle, so there was almost nobody to defend the home front. And those that were blasted out of the sky in short, surprised order. Our destroyers also made quick work of the Wyidians' major spaceport, shattering the kilometers-long structure at critical junctures, which allowed the port's own centripetal forces to tear it apart. No need to waste more ammo than necessary. No skip pods were detected as launched to alert Wyidian forces in the Earnhardt system to our attack, so they wouldn't know they were duped until it was too late. If any of the Wyidian forces survived the battle there, they would return home to find nowhere to dock or repair. Our forces would be long gone when they arrived. With the local space cleared of threats, the CDF leisurely targeted industrial centers, military bases, mines, refineries, desalination plants, dams, solar arrays, harbors, space launch facilities, major highways, and any other target that would require the Wyidians to rebuild it before rebuilding their interstellar capabilities. After 6 hours of solid, unremitting pummeling, the Wyidians had been effectively pushed back to the days of internal combustion engines, and would be likely to stay there for a while. The CDF avoided a wide-scale random bombing of major cities, since wanton civilian death was not the goal. CDF intelligence suspected major casualties downstream of the destroyed dams, but that really couldn't be helped. There would have been no way for the Wyidians to stop the CDF from cratering the major cities, but the thinking was the Wyidians would have enough problems with the disease, famine, and political and social unrest than inevitably comes as a result of having your industrial and technological base yanked out from under you. Therefore, actively going after the civilian population was seen as inhumane and, equally as important to the CDF brass, an inefficient use of resources. Aside from the capital city, which was targeted strictly as an exercise in psychological warfare, no ground attacks were even considered. Not that the Wyidians in the capital seemed to appreciate that. Projectiles and beams were bouncing off our troop transports even as we landed. It sounded like hail and frying eggs on the hull. Two by two, Vivero said, pairing up the squad. No one goes off on their own. Refer to your maps and don't get trapped. Perry, you got Bender watch. Try to keep him from signing any peace treaties, if you please. And as an added bonus, you two are first out the door. Get high and deal with snipers.
Bender,
I motioned him over.
Set your MP for rockets and follow me. Camo on. Brain pal chatter only.
The transport ramp went down and Bender and I sprinted out the door. Directly in front of me at 40 meters was an abstract sculpture of some description. I nailed it as Bender and I ran.
Never much liked abstract art.
I was heading for a large building northwest of our landing position. Behind the glass in its lobby I could see several Wa'idians with long objects in their paws. I launched a couple of missiles in their direction. The missiles would impact on the glass. They probably wouldn't kill the Wa'idians inside, but they'd distract them long enough for Bender and I to disappear. I messaged Bender to blow out a window on the building's second floor. He did, and we launched ourselves at it, landing in what looked like a suite of office cubicles. Hey, even aliens have got to work. No live Wa'idians to speak of, however. I imagine most of them had stayed home from work that day.